and apologize for being a little bit late. Thank you for hanging in with us. Yes, Representative Butler has checked his watch and has concluded that we were a little late. And we will call Hasina Squires and Jim Green, who are going to come up before the lunch break, but we just didn't have time. So they were gracious enough to come back, and will talk to us this afternoon.
You can sit in the big one.
I'll sit over here.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. And this morning as I was sitting here, it kind of flashed back to a 12-step program. I'm Jim Green, and I'm a PERS member. My wife is a PERS member, too, so I have to be very careful about what I say. This morning as I left the house, my wife said, "Now don't ruin our retirement, or you can't come home." And I said, "Well, I also have to take a look at who signs my check." And we represent 198 school districts, 21 ESDs, 17 community colleges, and the State Board of Education. They are all PERS-covered employers. We have a rather large share of the PERS fund. We have a large share of the unfunded actuarial liability for our schools as well. It is a very complex system. There's no question about that. In reading through the statutes that PERS provided, their booklet of statutes, I guess one of the other confessions I need to make is I'm a lawyer. I guess that's two strikes, PERS member and a lawyer. And it is one of the most complex, convoluted statutes that you could read in the ORSs. Very close to the state school fund formula, but very complex. And there's been an argument that we need to scrap the system in order to make it a more streamlined system, make it more easily understandable. That may be where we need to go. The plan's been around for a long time, and there have been numerous changes to it, add-ons, subtractions, and Mr. Voitko is exactly correct. They have a very tough duty in trying to discern exactly what it is the legislative intent with regard to the plan is, and they've done a very good job of trying to get to where I believe you folks want them to be. There is a problem, though, and I think Nancy Brewer highlighted that. In an era when we had the highest earnings in the stock market in the history, there were employer rate increases of threefold. That was a shock to school districts. For a long time, many of you know, school districts are pooled. Our rates are pretty stable because of that. But we also have one of the highest rates for pooled folks. We're currently at 12.73. When those rates go up, those have dramatic impacts on school district budgets. There's been growing concern over this with regard to what we need to do about the PERS system. My phone calls probably prior to the whole issue coming up and PERS rates going up, I would get one or two calls a week about PERS. Now I average 25 to 30 calls a week from our member districts, their administrators, with regard to PERS, what's going on with PERS, with actuarial tables, so on and so forth. I think the letter that Nancy Brewer and her testimony gave you, we've participated in a work group with them. Many of the things that she mentioned in her letter we would be interested in taking a look at, but I also have some political practicality as well. Are they all doable? Probably not. There are associations and groups in this building that wouldn't support all those. And I think through the work of your task force, because at the first meeting you said, let's get around the table, let's talk about these issues, let's see what we can do, is probably going to be the program that will work. We want to be part of that. We want to make sure that when we do either create a new system or make adjustments to the system that we have, we create a public employee pension system that provides an adequate benefit that also has portability in it. Because one of the main things we're seeing right now in our school system is we are not having a lot of folks move up through the system. Used to be a teacher would become a principal or vice principal. Principal would move up into the administration, eventually maybe someday become a superintendent. We're not seeing that. We are seeing a significant shortage of superintendents. The outlook over the next 10 to 12 years is very bleak with regard to folks gaining their administrative license and becoming a superintendent. We are seeing more school districts look outside their traditional bounds for finding superintendents and finding administrators. Part of that issue deals with retirement, though, because as we look to the private sector, one of the issues we want to take a look at is portability, the ability for them to move their retirement accounts into a system that they want to come to work in. They're highly qualified. They become very good administrators. One of the issues I know they had in Seattle when they hired the retired colonel was a retirement system, and they had to come up with a compensation plan for him. That's something that districts in Oregon are taking a look at right now when they hire non-traditionally licensed superintendents to come up through the system. We are about $1.5 billion of the unfunded actuarial liability is attributed to school districts across the state. That is a large number. That is a number that all of the school districts are financing with PERS at 8% for 27 years. We worked with Representative Canope, members of the committee here, on getting our bonding bill through. I think this was our third iteration of that. I think we've got it right this time. There is a study that we have done, OSBA is commissioned from Eco Northwest, that will be released next Monday or Tuesday to show, is it financially and economically viable for school districts to go to the bond market to pay off their UAL? And I will tell you right now, that is terrible public policy. It is absolute horrible public policy to have to go to the bond market, get yourself in debt, and pay off a pension benefit. But if it is financially and economically viable, you're getting about 6.5% out in the bond market where you financed it with 8% with PERS. Does it make sense to do that? Perhaps. It depends on the long term. What you're really doing is playing a legal arbitrage game. You're trying to get the bond to be less than your actual cost to PERS, and that's arbitrage under the federal law. Since it's a taxable issuance, we can actually do a legal arbitrage, which is a little bit unique for school districts in the state of Oregon. We are in a position right now where we have many school districts in the state of Oregon that are looking at their budgets, and they don't have a budget yet, really, and they're looking at their costs, and they're saying 12.73% of payroll, plus if they've done the 6% pickup through collective bargaining, that's about 18.73, and a letter from Mr. Voigtko that came out to him earlier this year that said rates could go up again. We've estimated rates could be as high for school districts as 18%. 18% of their salary would be covered in a PERS benefit. That is a dramatic impact on school district budgets. Do we believe the system should be scrapped to do that? We don't know. We believe this process, the task force, the governor's task force that our executive director is sitting on, is going to take a look at all that. Our hope is that everybody in the building that has concerns around this can sit down around a table, much like the Mahonia Hall with regard to workers' comp over a decade ago now, sit down and try to fix this issue. We want to have a good benefit system for our employees. We don't want to have a benefit system that breaks the backs of taxpayers, however. And ultimately, in our system right now, whenever there is a cost to PERS, employers pay that, i.e. taxpayers pay that. And we are hearing time and time again in budget committees all over the state with regard to school districts, they want something done with regard to PERS. And what we've told our members, many of you received this document that we sent out with regard to understanding the cost of the PERS system. I think we handed it out during the last special session. There's not much districts can really do. Really, they have to pay those bills when they come in. The one thing they can do, and one of the things they're looking at, is the 6% pickup. Do you take that out of current collective bargaining agreements, or what can you do with that? Currently, about 65% of our districts do the 6% pickup for the employees. We are seeing many of our school districts, though, want to put language in their contracts that would drop that. Those are very hard-fought battles at the collective bargaining table. Once you get things like that in a collective bargaining agreement, they're very hard to get out, but they are working on that. We would like to see the legislature do something with regard to PERS that doesn't make the system more complex and doesn't breed lawsuits. Because one of the things that happens in a lawsuit, if the public employee unions file a lawsuit or the employers file a lawsuit, and if PERS is found to have done something wrong or the state is found to do something wrong and there's damages owed, guess who has to pay that bill? It's the employers and then from the taxpayers. And we want to be sure that when we work with you on those things, that we have the best legal advice available to us and that the parties around the table have agreement. Because if you don't have agreement, what's going to happen is a lawsuit. Those take years, they cost millions of dollars, and if there are damages, that's one of the reasons our UAL is where it's at, because of the taxation issue. We want to make sure that the system is viable and legally okay, and also the ability for portability, as I mentioned, one other issue that school districts have that has come to light in the last couple of months is an issue around substitute teachers or substitute employees. Once you work more than 600 hours, you're considered a PERS-covered employer or employee. We have many school districts who hire a substitute teacher, a substitute bus driver, substitute janitor, cook, what have you, and they don't work 600 hours for that school district, but throughout the school year, they may have worked 600 hours. We have a school district down in Lane County that just received a bill from PERS for over $24,000 for an employee that worked for them over 20 years ago.
and they didn't know that that employee had worked 600 hours. PERS does not provide that type of information to school districts. School districts are not required to provide that information to PERS. We have brought a piece of legislation to do that in the past, and we will do that again this next session. Districts need to know that. That is a very small school district down in Lane County that doesn't have $24,000 in its budget to pay a PERS benefit due to an individual who worked for the district over 20 years ago. We want to have the ability to have from PERS to say, you're coming up on that, you got to start withholding it. Now, the Substitute Teachers Association has opposed that, saying that, well, you won't hire us if we get to 599 hours. There is not the pool of substitute employees across the state of Oregon to make that happen. What we want, essentially, is just to know you got to start setting aside funds for it, because this school district and several other school districts in the state are handed those bills for employees that worked for them maybe 15, 20 years ago. And it's a budgetary impact that they're not ready to deal with, nor did they contemplate. So we will bring a piece of legislation to deal with that. We're going to sit down and talk to the Substitute Teachers Association about that and explain the situation as well. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and look forward to working with your task force and this committee as we work through this very complex issue.
Jim, it almost sounded like that you were asking the legislature to pass a mandate on school districts and on PERS. Are you really asking the legislature for a mandate?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I guess we are asking for a mandate. We want mandated reporting so we know when somebody's hitting 600 hours. It's just, it only makes sense. And from the area that Representative Butler comes from, RESDs coordinate the substitutes, and they work for, you know, 20, 30 school districts out in rural eastern Oregon. But which one do you attach the amount to? Isn't known, and when do you start setting that money aside? And those little school districts need to know that. So, yeah, I guess we're asking for a mandate.
Yeah, sounds reasonable. I just wanted to hear you say it. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, I just this issue of a teacher coming forward 24 years later, 20 years later, when that happens, I assume that there should have been some match. Did the employee match, do you know, and that particular situation in Lane County?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I don't know in that particular instance, but what happens with the pickup or that is going to be dependent on a collective bargaining agreement, if there is one in existence between the substitute teacher and the school district. We only have about four districts that do that. This district did not. So I'm assuming that PERS also sent to the individual, and you might want to ask Mr. Voitko and Mr. Delaney that in this instance, but they generally send them a bill as well saying your portion that is due is this amount.
Follow up, Ms.
Fowler.
Thank you. Jim, how do these projected unfunded accrued liabilities to schools in Oregon, how does that relate to their current and future hiring capacity relative to a $1.5 billion UAL?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, it depends on the individual districts. It would depend on their financial situation. We have some school districts that do have some cash carry forwards and reserves left that they are going to pay off a portion or much of their UAL with. We have 80 school districts prior to a glitch that came up this last time. We had 80 school districts that had signed a letter of intent to go into this bond program. It does impact them because I'll take the example of Portland Public Schools. If they bond and pay off their UAL in the current bond market, it could potentially save them in excess of $2 million this next year. That's $2 million into their budget to either hire staff, build back program, or just sustain what's going on in the school district currently. We have a list that was provided to us by Seattle Northwest that showed if they went to the bond market today, each school district, kind of guessing what their UAL is because you need to get the accurate number from PERS, what would be the total cost savings? And I can provide that to you if you'd like to take a look at that. Some districts, it was so small, it wouldn't make sense for them to go to the bond market. But when you talk Portland, $2 million a year, Salem, a little over $1 million, you know, some of our larger school districts, you're talking some very significant money. And even in some of our medium to smaller size school districts, may not talk about a large dollar, but it's a large portion of their budget. The ability to pay that off could save them money. The ability to hire and do program planning in the future, that's hard to say because we haven't had the valuation for PERS this next time around. We know there's another UAL coming, an unfunded actuarial liability. We've told our districts that. I think it's one thing they always take a look at when they're taking a look at their budgets. And I would hope the member of the committee, who's now one of my members, when he sits on his budget committee down in his school district, takes a look at that, because it is becoming a large portion when you look at human resource costs in the school district.
Other questions?
Yeah, I was appointed to the Springfield School Board. Lately, I don't think I have a conflict of interest, so you're tired of hearing that, no?
It's a very high-paying job.
It's not as high-paying as a legislature, though. The mandate that I want to appreciate first staff and the executive director for being here, you know, through the whole day. I mean, they could have been elsewhere, but having them available for being able to respond to questions that come up are real valuable. Of course, they're not hearing a word I'm saying, because they're, you know, they got more important. But thanks for being here. I think it's possible, though, that we don't necessarily have to do, you know, a mandate legislatively. This may be something that PERS board, you know, would be able to do. I think, you know, maybe some cost attribution might make some difference, because clearly the information you're asking for would be a benefit to the employers. But anytime you have a cost, then the costs are paid for out of, you know, plan earnings or obligations. That reduces the amount of money available for benefits. But I think that it's a benefit for employees to also know what their future benefit would be. But it'd be nice to have some knowledge of whether we need to address it, or that's an issue that's resolvable. And, you know, maybe the, you know, PERS director, after her testimony, you know, could give some comment on, in terms of being able to address that. Helps out some.
Sounds good.
One other follow-up for Jim, Mr. Chair. I just like your reaction, Jim, on the pooling. And we've had some information that maybe we should have mandatory pooling with many, many types of agencies.
Pooling of employers for trying to stabilize their balance.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we have in the past not supported that. We believe that's the choice of the local government. We're mandated pooled. School districts across the state with the education service districts are pooled into one pool. Has it provided us rate stability? Yeah. We have the highest rate, not because of that, though. We have a high rate because once you enter into the school system as an employee, very unlikely that you leave. You're more likely to have longevity in the school pool than in any other of the employers across the state. You become a teacher, you stay a teacher until you retire, generally. If it's proven that it can provide rate stability and it helps the fund and it would lower employer costs and taxpayer costs and provide the benefit system, we would take a look at that. Traditionally, we have not supported it. We believe that's an issue of local control. When we talked about doing the bonding program, that's how we created it, though. We created it through a pooled system. They're going to go out to the market at one time. You talked about earlier this morning, you know, the credit ratings of the various and the sundry local governments out there. We're doing an intercept agreement where the payment for the bonded indebtedness will come from the state school fund payment prior to it going to the district. And essentially what Moody's has told us is we'll get almost the state rate for that. So school districts that have a very hard time with a bond rating can get almost the AA plus. It's probably going to be AA minus is what we're told.
Great. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires here today on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. And seeing that you are 40 minutes behind schedule, I will try my very best to be as brief as possible. I am not a PERS member. I believe that I collected PERS for 2 years back 10 years ago or something and pulled all my money out. But I do have a husband who has about, I think, 30 years in the system. I can't remember. A lot of years in the system, tier one employee. And when he asked me, what are you doing today, honey? I said, I'm going to one of the task forces, governor speaker. I can't remember it. And instead of rolling his eyes or making a comment, because we've had so many of these conversations at home, it was just dead silence. The conversation just ended. So I think he's bored with the issue, as bored and fed up and tired as a lot of people are with the issue. It is a complicated issue, and a lot of people just really don't want to talk about it anymore. We very much appreciate, on behalf of the association, the speaker's willingness to create this task force. We were one of the few associations that did support Representative King's bill during the 2001 legislative session. House Bill 3734 testified in support of it. If nothing else, If the world can't, if the PERS system can't be solved or dismantled or whatever it is that ends up happening with all of these very complicated issues, if nothing else, I think the public's awareness of the system and employees' awareness of how the system affects them and for employers too has been heightened. And I think in the end, it may be very painful to get to some sort of solutions, fixes, tweaking, clarity, all of those types of issues. But in the end, I think we'll probably all be better served after having spent hours and countless hours examining all of the complications of the PERS system. The Special Districts Association, we have approximately 800 members in our association, approximately 26 different types of special districts. Only approximately 240 of those districts, though, participate in the PERS system. I would say probably another 300 of those districts don't have, 300 of the 8 don't have an employee, so they're all volunteers. So we do have a number of special districts that are not PERS employers. Having said all of that, we represent, aside from the school districts, approximately half of the local governments that are to participate in PERS. So if you look at cities, counties, and special districts, we're half of that, so to speak, pooled group of employers. It's not really a pool. It's a bad example. Our association has in the past not supported a third tier of PERS because we have not been convinced that the data exists, and we have not been able to convince our membership, not that we've been out there advocating to our membership, but our membership has not seen any data that has led them to believe that the second tier of PERS does not solve unfunded liability issues for local governments. And so I do want to start with that preface and premise. Our association is very conservative when it comes to arguing for or against benefits for its employees. We are we feel that we're at a competitive disadvantage at times with cities and counties to try to recruit and retain employees. Particularly for rural fire protection districts, recruitment and retention of employees. Would you rather work for City of Portland Bureau of Environmental Services or the, no offense, I live in this area, Oak Lodge Water District? Well, I know which one I would pick. Some people, it's a different lifestyle, but for us, recruitment and retention of employees is a significant issue. One thing that I would point out to you that I handed out to you is the 2000 valuation. What is in this in this document is some pretty interesting information, and I encourage you to look at it in the context of what special districts or cities and counties you have within your legislative district. The story is different for each local government. Some of our employers are very concerned about their PERS costs. Others not so concerned, and it really varies within our membership. The valuation information that I handed out to you contains the current employer rates for each employer, unfunded liabilities, and the percent of funded status that each employer has, and the percent of Tier 1 employees, which is becoming a more notable factor when you're looking at what the makeup of your workforce is. And then also the number of employees and the total annual salary of those of the district or city or county. And the reason I point that out is because you'll see, like in certain instances, Clackamas County Vector Control District with a 23% employer rate, or Burnt River Irrigation District with a huge employer rate, but they've got $20,000 in payroll. So I think that rather than making generalizations about what averaging out what employer contribution rates are for special districts, I think it really needs to be viewed in specific instances. A couple of things that I would just want to, especially with the pooling issue, there are very few issues that get special districts worked up about PERS, and pooling is one of those issues. It is a hot button for our membership. Our membership is absolutely opposed to mandatory pooling of local government employers. We have been from the start. It started with a PERS staff recommendation. We believe the legislature affirmed our position in Senate Bill 134 that created voluntary pooling, and we would oppose any change to that. And the issue is this. It is about local control, but it is also about protecting the interests of those local government employers who have been paying 6% for as long as they can remember, for 20 years. They pay 6%. They join the pool, their rate increases. It's an unfunded mandate. They make the decision to stay out of the pool. Whether or not they have rate fluctuations, they're not the ones that are coming in here and complaining about rate volatility. They're the people that are paying 6%. They believe that if they have a disability and their rate goes through the roof, they ought to pay for it. It's their ratepayers that should pay for a disability and an increased cost of PERS. In a pooled system, an employer who didn't have a disability will be affected by another employer, so another employer's disability or poor work practices or what have you. So that is a very hot button issue with our association, and we would oppose any change to that.
How do you really feel about it?
No. Yeah, see, as you can tell, I've been primed by the membership to make sure that I make that point very clear. A couple of things that I just want to, I would really echo most of the comments that Mr. Green has previously stated, and I do want to be quick. A couple of things that I do want to point out, with regard to House Bill 3349, I don't want to be pointing fingers to the legislature, but the legislature did enact that mandate onto local governments, and from the best of my recollection, it was about a 1.3% average payroll cost increase to local government employers, and that's when we started hearing from our employers. People, one, didn't know why they were getting socked with this bill when they did nothing wrong, and two, wanted to know why their rates started to increase. And so that, to us, was the crux of the beginning of the end for this whole PERS discussion, because that's really when people started to go, that's when the phone calls started coming into our association. Compound that by employers not vesting in the variable at the same rate as employees and failure to recognize the money match, and in our opinion, that's the whole shooting match. That's where it all comes from, and that's where it started and where the big chunks of money are, where the big costs to employers are coming from. It would be wonderful if the legislature chose to reverse their position on House Bill 3349 and fund that 1.3%. 39% employer costs to cities, counties, special districts. It'd be great. I don't know how the state would possibly be able to do that with its current budget constraints, but it is an issue that is brought up every legislative session, and there is legislation, as Representative Butler is aware, that brings that issue to the forefront, and we would certainly support that. One thing that I do want to point out, because it was. And I want to say it with as much tact as possible. The statement that when employers hire employees that retirement is not a factor, that is a factor for our local governments. In fact, there is a special district in the room that was not a PERS employer up until about a year or two ago, and being part of that PERS system was a significant benefit to its employees, and the board chose to join the PERS system. It is a question that is asked when we are trying to recruit and retain employees, do you have PERS? Because most of these employers are coming from cities or counties, and they want that benefit. So in our opinion, it is a question that's asked right up front. It's right up there with health care. What kind of, do you have Kaiser, do you have ODS, what do you have, and do you have PERS? Because I need to continue, I want that portability, and that is a significant issue for the rural fire protection districts in this state. With regard to the testimony that was submitted by the city of Corvallis, we really, out of that memorandum, there are about four issues that we would really encourage you to focus on. We are very concerned about the mortality table being outdated. We do support the five-year wear away. We're very pleased to see that the PERS board, hopefully on Monday, will be making a decision about which option they choose to implement, or at least directing the staff to hurry and get the administrative rulemaking process. Whatever happens with it, it will probably end up being litigated, but our opinion is let's get the show on the road, and I'm sure that, I think Mary Botkin was quoted in the paper as saying that, so I guess I would echo her on that. The issue of opting out is an issue that has been raised to us by our membership. Some of districts would like to opt out, but other districts do not want the system terminated. They want to continue to have the PERS system, so opt out as long as it's voluntary. And it is a local decision, not a decision made by the legislature. We encourage the legislature to continue to examine the board membership. I do not mean to say any, please don't take my comments as the board is irresponsible. The issue of having people who are qualified and have pension experience is is just imperative. The system is so complicated that those of us who sit in the audience and listen to this for 3, 4, 5 years, 6 years now, there are things that we learn that we didn't know about. And it's just an issue that we hope that you continue to explore, regardless of whether or not it's employers or employees, that their positions become private sector employees. We would like more private sector private sector persons without PERS interests on the PERS board. And then this whole issue of equal versus sequential earnings crediting, which you'll hear about shortly, is a very significant issue if that system is changed. I guess one of our frustrations is that every time we turn around, there seems to be one other time bomb. And this happens to be one of those, so we're pleased to see that you'll be taking that issue up today from the PERS staff, and would encourage you to dig deep into that issue.
Thank you. Questions?
I have.
Representative Butler.
Just as soon as I look at your handout here, I know some of the 2000 rates, well, even the 1999 rates for some of the districts, are minus rates. How does that work practically?
Chair Cano, Representative Butler, and Pierce can probably correct me if I'm wrong. The negative rates, I believe these are normal cost rates. So these are the actual rates that would. I believe the negative rate indicates that that's what the normal cost rate is, that there's such a surplus there. And all local government employers are required to pay at least 6%. I think that's what the negative rate comes
from. Okay. Mr. Chair, I don't know what kind of disclaimers are being made here today, but the three highest percentage rates in the 2000 and some of the 1999 rates here are all within House District 60. So as long as everyone is making these various disclaimers, I guess I'd better fess up to the fact that Burnt River is in Baker County and my House District, and the city of Huntington is a 64% rate, is in Baker County within my district, and the city of Vail at 16% rate, 16.37, is within my district. So some of the very highest rates are within House District 60, which is, I've worn my hat that says that I represent more cows than I do people. So.
Chair Canope, Representative Butler, hence the you may want to peruse the sheet comment that I made earlier. One other thing that I would just add briefly is I'd be happy to provide the committee with a listing of local, I know I have for special districts dating back to 1989, each local government employer's rate from each valuation. I know I have that information from 1989 to the current year. There are a few gaps because some employers, the information just wasn't available, but PERS has been gracious enough to provide us with all of those individual valuations, and I have many a binder in the office, and it's been put into a spreadsheet, so I'd be happy to submit that to you.
Great, that'd be terrific. Representative King.
Thank you. I don't want your information going back past 89, actually. Got enough. Maybe PERS can comment on that question when they get a chance to come up. I do notice that your information here is your 2000. I suspect that's the most recent that you've got. It would be helpful, whether it's you or PERS, maybe at next meeting, to have more current numbers than that, at least through 2001, because I'm pretty sure they're dramatically different. So this is the light version of a problem, and we're here at this table because there's more significant numbers out there, and that'd be helpful to have. My understanding is that your report on page 10, for those members that may not have looked over there, the total actuarial liabilities are on page 10 as versus individual entities. And I think that might be interesting numbers for us to look at.
Thank you.
Next, I think we're going to have PERS agency come back up and give us a little bit of background on a couple of things. One is a response to some of the questions that have been asked back to May. And I don't know which one of you is going to handle the sequential and even crediting, but I feel bad for you. And I may even feel worse after I hear it. I don't know. We'll see. Go ahead.
Well, Chair Canope, it's the task force that I have sympathy for when we inflict these kinds of things on folks. I find myself every time I respond to a legislator saying I am apologizing for the complexity of the answer, but it's just the way it is. Chair Canope, members of the task force, you asked us a series of questions at the close of your last meeting, and we have provided for you written responses, and I would like to go through those briefly if that's okay. But I won't spend a great deal of time. I'll give you highlights and you can follow up with questions. And we have one revision that I'll mention. We did some additional research on a question and something that's come up quite often, and I think that we want to make sure we touch on that. So if I could proceed that way.
Go ahead.
You asked for a copy of a document that I referred to at the last meeting called the Cost Effectiveness Measurement Study. Just so that you know, we put in the executive summary. There is a much larger analysis. You can see from the summary that this third-party organization is under contract to us and to many other pension plans to do a cost-based analysis of the operations of the system. And the detail at which they work is surprisingly low level. They come in and work directly with our staff. Very impressive organization. And I guess in summary, I would turn to page 19 of the executive summary, which is the last page, and because I think it summarizes their conclusion about our system to date. And the headline of that page is, your system, the Oregon PERS, is close to median costs. That is that the costs we do for our various services and in aggregate are very close to those that they consider comparable systems.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, I go to page 18 and then that's no more.
Whoops. I think it's a double-sided copy. It's a page that has six graphs on it.
Page 19, you see?
Yeah, it's page 19 of the executive summary, did we not?
Hold on.
Are you in the middle?
We're all looking there. On page 18.
Oh, okay.
Which one?
Towards the very back.
We're trying to save paper.
It's kind of actually in the first third, I'd say.
We're looking for...
That's yep. The one,
yeah.
Representative Kim.
All right.
That's exactly right.
Thank you. I beg your pardon.
So this organization surveys us, I believe it's each year, and they also provide recommendations, but mostly they provide comparable data. And their conclusion on looking at our system is that our system is very close to the median costs experienced by systems of like nature, and that they are surprised that that's true because our system is more complex than average and our workloads are generally higher. This is basically a reflection of something that we've talked about often at task force meetings, and that is that the complexity of the statute and the programs and the multiple types of calculations are not totally unknown in the world of public pension plans, but obviously ours are at a level that places us at the very highest end. In fact, in conversations with them, they would say that we might not be the most complicated pension system, but we're in the top five is the answer that I got back. So we're kind of proud.
In the world or in the U.S.?
That's in, you can see the array of pension plans they study is North America, and in fact it extends on into Canada, Australia, and some of the European countries, and it includes virtually every large pension plan of public pension plan of consequence in the U.S. So it's against a very comprehensive universe.
Yeah, we're number one.
Everybody likes to be on top. So we're somewhat proud of the fact that despite our complexity and that our workloads are generally higher, that our median costs are in line. But I'm not sure that that's good news, quite frankly. And I'll tell you why. Because you can lower costs and express the consequences of that in other areas. And in other areas, I would say that sacrificing accuracy, for example, is one of them. I don't think that our agency, and I speak as one at least now partly responsible for it, has met the tests of accuracy that, at least in my professional judgment, we should be meeting. And so the fact of the matter is that there's a possibility that we're able to reach these low-cost levels only by sacrificing some accuracy in our calculations. And I believe the audit division, if you were to have them come and talk to you about past audits and ongoing audits that we're working with them cooperatively on, they would say the same thing. Any questions on the cost-effectiveness measurement study? If not, I'll move on to your second question.
Representative King.
My suspicion, though, is that at least for the short while, that if we give you the money to get a new administrative system, that you would increase your efficiency, but you would might look cost ineffective because the cost of the new administration system would be so high.
Chair Canope, Representative King, that's partly true. The study's analysis takes into account capital expenditures and does amortize them through a number of years, so that we wouldn't see a huge bulge in our costs. But there would be some of that effect. That's correct. And again, I would not, given that we are recommending that the infrastructure of the system be improved, I would argue that that's a good thing. But opinions differ. Question number two was, are there legal cases that would prevent an employer from choosing to opt out of PERS? You heard Ms. Squires talk about this issue. We did some preliminary research, and again, on the question of an official opinion of law, we would defer to the Department of Justice. But our analysis is that it would be very difficult for an employer to, under the current statute, to exit from PERS. There's a possibility that the statute could be changed to allow prospective employees of that PERS employer to exit, but allowing existing employers to exit would certainly raise issues of contract rights. How the courts would settle those, we have continually said we don't know for sure, but certainly signing up to PERS under a PERS pension system and with an existing PERS employer imply some kind of agreement for sure. So the opt-out issue for existing employees looks problematic, to say the least. For prospective employers, it would probably still require action by the legislature if that were deemed desirable by you. The third question is, what is the PERS board's authority to collect money from employers? Representative Butler asked some very pointed questions about in the last task force session about our authority to do so, particularly if the locality was experiencing significant financial difficulties. We heard one employer say that she had mused about not paying her PERS bill. We hope that she was kidding. We have very strong statutory authority to require employers to pay their PERS bills. We are a creditor, we have clear statutory authority to assess the actuarially required amounts that are needed from employers in the form of contributions to make sure that the plan is adequately funded. We also looked into, at least on a cursory basis, what might happen with respect to a public employer bankruptcy, and I don't mean to be alarmist here. We've only ever had one employer in a public meeting say that they were considering such a move. We have another employer that we've been in long-running litigation around with respect to PERS obligations, but at the moment, that issue from a point of view of how often we have encountered it is small, but we believe, again, we have very strong claims on the assets or the ability or the whatever means that entity has to pay its bills. And our understanding is, and this is just our understanding, we would defer to the Department of Justice again, that a municipality within the state of Oregon can't file bankruptcy without the permission of the state. We're not anticipating that this is an issue, but we're also not denying, and you've heard it from people testifying here today, that PERS and other budgetary pressures are certainly, somebody said a double squeeze, was that the term, maybe it's a triple or a quadruple squeeze, are being experienced at the local and the state level. I can only tell you that we are only experts such as we are in the pension system. We have very little knowledge to offer you about the state and nature of local budgets and the pressures that bear on them. Question number five was, what part of the 51% increase in retirement benefits over the past 10 years is attributable to HB 3349 that was discussed today? We have a memorandum in the package that shows that it was a significant item, and it's quantified, I think, at it was cited earlier at 1.3% of payroll from the funding point of view. So it was not trivial, but it's not the only item in play, and it is a fixed amount. I think we are currently grossing up, on average, a benefit of about 9 to 10% each time we do a calculation to adjust for the taxation of those benefits, and that will go on in time, but that amount is not growing. That is a fixed amount. Changes in rates from this point forward have to do more with changes subsequent to HB 3349, investment results being an example, growth in additional pension obligations being an example. There was also a question about the summary of actuarial equivalency factor tables for all ages. We have submitted a report as well as some of the underlying mortality tables. I don't know too much more to what I can offer here that would advance your discussion. We, as you know, the board is meeting on Monday, is considering a variety of options, most notably the five-year wear away or some year wear away, some period, as well as the multiple segment approach. We expect that we'll be instructed by the board to begin drafting a rule implementing one or another of those policies or some other one that they should decide on at that meeting. The end result will be the implementation of a new mortality table policy, whatever that may be, which then will be used to take account balances and decide what monthly annuity is produced by that account balance. So we'll have quite a bit more to talk to you about, I presume, at your next meeting. Question number seven, regarding the PERS retirement benefit. Was the original formula intended to provide 50 to 60% of the member's final average salary? I've been asked that question for the last 2 years, and I've constantly gone back to staff and asked the question, where is this coming from? I don't see it in the statute. They didn't see it in the statute. We just continued to work on it, and I want to give a pat on the back to one of my staffers who went back and actually looked at pieces of the statute which fell out during past revisions. In 1967, there was a revision of the statute, I believe, and sections of it fell away. It turns out that one of the sections that fell away explicitly addressed the issue of what the legislature's intentions were. And have we passed around a copy? The bottom line is that those old items did two things. One is they set a roughly 50%. 50 to 60% in some cases, target for what the retirement benefit should be as a measure of final average salary, and did so also with explicit recognition of whether those members were eligible for Social Security or not. I'm not sure that you're aware, but there are some systems that explicitly factor in available Social Security into their retirement benefit structure in the future, and there are many which do not. Now, of course, this is no longer in statute, but our response was that we could find that we could find no reference to these goals in the legislative history. It turns out to be false, and we want to correct that. This is in the legislative history, however, it is no longer part of current statute. Question: how many PERS members retire with more than 100% of final average salary? We would ask the task force's indulgence here. We've been asked this question, as you can imagine, many times, and particularly during the last regular session, we produced as quickly as we could an analysis of this question, a table that's been shown widely around. we are within a week or so of completing a much more comprehensive analysis of this question, which will not only answer the question how many people retire at what percents of their final average salary or their last three highest years, but we will also do it by time period, by length of service, by general service versus PNF. We'll also do it by segregating out those people who were inactive for most of the period in which we had their accounts, but they were vested so that their accounts kept growing by earnings crediting. What we want to do is to lay out the facts on this issue, which obviously is somewhat controversial, in as clear and disaggregated a way as possible, and hope that it'll be sort of the facts of record about what the system is actually producing now, and give us some insight as to what the circumstances are when it produces a benefit that is a very high ratio of final average salary, or a very low ratio, as some of your other witnesses today have referenced. So I would ask the opportunity to complete that analysis and present it to the task force. There's a question also about what the PERS annual budget is. We have from our budget in the analysis here today those budgeted figures. What we've also tried to do in the table in the middle of the page, and this is in the bottom of the answer to question number 9, what is the PERS annual budget, give you a sense of what our budget looks like in the context of the operation we run. From the point of view of contribution flows that we manage, our budget is about 3.6% of those contributions. In terms of the benefit payments that we make each year, and we make very substantial benefit payments, you can see that it's approaching $1.6 billion, it's about 2.5%. And as a percent of the total fund assets that we manage, total fund assets being not just OPERS, but also deferred compensation and the retiree health insurance trust funds, it's less than a tenth of a percent. We offer those as perspective because it's not that the raw numbers don't tell a story. They certainly do. Each dollar stands on its own weight, if you will. But it also has to be measured against the job that it's thrown against. Question number 10, provide materials that might answer how the board got to our present circumstance of using outdated mortality tables. We've answered that by setting forth a chronology of actual events. When people ask that question, they often are looking for motivations, and we can't look into the heads of people in 1978, 84, 91, 98, and ask the question of sort of why they made the decisions they did. All we have is the written record and the actions to go on. So we've arrayed those in a chronology for you to give you a sense of the sequence of decisions that were made that have gotten us to the present circumstance. That brings us to number 11, which is equal and sequential crediting. There are two ways that we can answer. We can give you the short answer, the long answer, or the six-hour answer. I'm assuming the six-hour answer is off the table. So if you want to get into it in more detail, we can do that, but give me some indication as to what your patience is for my...
Well, why don't you give us the short answer and see if we have confused looks after the short answer, and then maybe we'll ask questions and ask you for the extended version, and then maybe we'll just pick up the six-hour version another day.
Okay. In the statute, there are somewhat counting subsections over 40 provisions that instruct the board as to how to take the earnings each year that accumulate on the trust fund and distribute them to accounts. The distribution is important because they are both for the employers the wherewithal which they fund benefits that they're obligated to pay. For the members, they're important because they are also the dollars that are available should they decide to take a refund. but they're also important because they are indicators through the annuitization process of what their benefit would be under Money Match. So this crediting process is absolutely central to Money Match, and so the method by which it's done is obviously something of terribly great importance to the pension plan. Over the years, the board has looked at these, and when I say years, I mean several decades. The board has looked at these 40 provisions, it's 44 now, I believe, and has started with the assumption that, well, there are all these accounts. Let's assume as a starting point that every dollar in every account that's invested in the same way earns its money. It gets the same earnings. It's equal crediting. And that's step number one. Step number two, then, though, is to look at what the legislature says has to be accomplished by earnings crediting. An example, the primary example is earnings crediting must, for example, deliver 8% to Tier 1 member accounts. So then you look at what actually was earned by the money in these accounts, and then you say, well, now I've got to find money. I've got to reallocate money, if you will, in some manner, either using reserves or some other mechanism, to make sure that I achieve what the legislature is instructing us to do in statute. And that's just one example. There are many others with respect to variable, for example, how you pay administrative expenses, and so on, because all of these things need to be fed by the earnings stream that comes off the trust fund, because we don't get outside money. We are a totally closed system. So for many years, that was the concept.
I think you said 8% by statute. My understanding is the 8% by the PERS board and by contract agreements that the legislature did not statute the 8% for non-police fire people. Am I missing something?
Chair Canope, Representative King, I think so, but this is an important concept. The 8% guarantee, which we bandy about, is not an 8% guarantee per se. It is in statute, so it is a statutory guarantee. And some would argue that it's constitutional in nature because of the link to the theory of contract rights. But it's set in statute, but the statute doesn't say 8%. The statute says that you shall guarantee whatever assumed rate that the board adopts for the plan as a whole. The assumed rate, of course, and we've dealt with this in a letter to Representative Butler in some length, the assumed rate is what the board, working with its actuary, believes the fund as a whole can earn over a very extended period of time, 30, 40 years. So, but once that's set, the statute automatically makes that the guaranteed rate. So one cannot change the guaranteed rate. It's like in software, when you set one thing, it just gets copied over to the other. To another cell. So the only way that the guarantee can change is if the board changed the assumed rate. And the assumed rate is an estimate of the future investment environment. So the link is in that way. So it doesn't distinguish between P&F and general service. And it can't be, under the statute, it can't be, the guaranteed rate can't be changed independently of the assumed rate.
So the legislature did not put in statute 8%. We have in statute, the assumed rate.
That's correct. And when the assumed rate was 7.5% that the board set, then the guaranteed rate was 7.5%. So things were going along merrily, we were doing many reviews of the, as you recall, of the dynamics of the Tier 1 system, and a number of questions came up about what we were doing in equal crediting. The net of that is that we did a complete review working with the Department of Justice on the 40-some provisions. And what emerged from that review was an alternative theory of how these 40-some provisions should work in concert, because they all get executed simultaneously. And that theory or construct of executing or implementing these 40 provisions is called sequential crediting. We named it that because it was indicative of the underlying theory. The underlying theory of equal crediting is each dollar sort of earns its own money, and then we have to adjust that to comply with whatever the statute says the outcomes have to be. Under sequential crediting, you read the statute as, and there's many opportunities to do so because the statute in many cases says, the board shall first, the board shall then, the board after doing this, the board shall. There is a way to read the statute that says that this is actually a very linear set of steps done sequentially, in which some entities or accounts have very high standing in the pecking order to get what their requirement is under statute out of the earnings stream before the remaining earnings pass down the pipe, if you will. The charts that we put in front of you, believe me, don't pay any attention to the details because we get lost in them sometimes. But the point that I'm trying to make by showing you these pictures is twofold. One is it's a very complex procedure under equal crediting or sequential crediting because the statute is complex. The second is that the linear nature of sequential crediting does mean that some accounts have their actuarial or statutory financial demands taken care of first before other entities. In general, the pecking order works from things like the contingency reserve and the Tier 1 guarantee have very high, Tier 1 members have very high standing. Employers, general employer accounts have very low standing in terms of that pecking order. So what has happened is that the board has been presented with these two and has conferred with the Department of Justice in executive session on at least several occasions, and has not yet completed the crediting for the year 2001. What has happened is that we've identified for the board all of those crediting moves that would be the same under either procedure, and those basically involve members. And we have executed those so that we could get member statements out. But the board has not yet decided whether or not to adopt sequential crediting as the correct interpretation of these many provisions in the statute or remain with equal crediting, but has to do so before the end of the year because the statute also says that the board shall, by the end of the following year, complete the crediting of earnings, in this case for the year 2000, it was losses, to 2001 rather, to the various accounts. So our clock is ticking, and this is something that the board, as soon as it gets through the mortality table question, is going to have to take up with some alacrity. So I hope I've given you at least a conceptual picture. What I want to stress is that there are many provisions in the statute that need to be executed simultaneously to do earnings crediting. Earnings crediting is very important. There is both a there are two paradigms that you can use to organize your implementation of these 40 provisions. One is more financially based, if you will. The other is more legally based, sort of reading the shall first parts of the statute in their literal words. And the board has to make a difficult decision by the end of the year as to how it's going to execute the wishes of the legislature. Let me stop there, and I'm sure I've confused you mightily.
Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
I just want to confirm that, that when you have a guaranteed rate established, then that also dictates by reducing this, and I, Representative King has asked a question relative to this guaranteed rate. If the guaranteed rate was reduced, then the rate of return, then the rate of earnings would also be reduced, and the assessments or proposed assessments to all of the participants then would be severely increased. So that's my recollection of some of the discussions which we've had. Do you have any feel, Jim, if the rate was to go from 7% or from 8% to 7%, if you're looking at increases to the participants right now of between 3.75 and 4.25, what would the 1% decrease in the guaranteed rate amount to as it translates back to the folks that are kicking this money in local districts, city counties, and special districts?
Under the current scheme, Chair Canope, Representative Butler, it would be substantial. It would be in the neighborhood of 5 percentage points of payroll, which with payroll being at $6.5 billion, it would be over $300 million increase in PERS assessments to employers. We have wrestled with this issue because many people have asked us what can be done about the Tier 1 guarantee. And our response is, well, we're not proposing that anything be done. But if you ask us, we'll tell you that there is a contract rights issue, without a doubt. Two is, there are financial consequences, which you just pointed out, that if you leave the monolithic system in place where we have one trust fund serving all of these various liabilities and we lower our estimate of future investment earnings, then in order to keep the system actuarially sound, we have to find some other money. Under our system, the only other money to be found is employer rates. One of the things we have broached that requires a lot more study is, why do we have to have one fund serving all of these purposes, meaning Tier 1 liabilities, which are different than Tier 2, which are different than the retiree fund? We have one single fund with one investment profile trying to satisfy a whole series of different investment needs, if you will. It's very similar to if you were fortunate enough to have children who were 18, 15, 7, and 1, and you were to start saving for their college. Well, the 18-year-old's a year away from college. You're probably not going to buy speculative stocks to try, because you got a year to get whatever you can before you have to start paying the college bills. But for the 1-year-old, you have a lot more time. So you might actually have different investment profiles for each one of those. Different investment profiles implies a different assumed rate. Different assumed rates imply, under the statute, a different guarantee. So what we have broached for consideration is, if it's the pleasure of the legislature and the stakeholders that you consult with, that one of the ways to try to do this anyway is to partition the system into its various components, just from an investment point of view, so that each liability has an investment profile that's appropriate for what that liability's features are. And we know from experience that the Tier 1 guarantee and its liability stream are very peculiar and particularly very sensitive to volatility. That was one of the key results of our first simulation exercise. So we've outlined this in a letter to your colleague in the other body, Senator Nelson, and we have not explored it further, although the PERS board has asked for a presentation on it, and the OIC has also asked for documents on it as well to try to figure out if it, you know, is feasible, and it's just an idea.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So that I can bring this to some conclusion in my own mind, based again upon Representative King's question, so that the bills, if you will, that were sent out indicating that local districts, cities, and counties were going to be assessed, increased in the assessment 3.75 to 4.25, if we were to lower the expectation from 8% to 7%, that billing would have stated something in the vicinity of 8.75 to 9.25% of their current payroll. Is that right?
Based on the back of the envelope analysis of our actuary, that's correct.
Thank you very much.
Another question for Representative King.
I would like to know, in a reasonable time frame, what's the underlying assumptions guiding the assumed rate. I suspect that 8% assumed rate during the 1990s is not a problem, but since there's no one out there willing to guarantee 8% today, I'm wondering, what's the logic that says that that's a reasonable assumed rate, and knowing that your body is going to do things that are actuarially sound, there must be something driving that. But I'm also, as I'm seeing our circumstance and what I'm hearing, I'm wondering, it seems like the underlying assumption is based upon sensible returns over a long period of time, like 10 or 30 years. But our obligations are based on annual tranches. And I'm starting to wonder if the underlying assumption takes into account the intermittent losses, particularly now that we're at a point of high values. So I think that the theory of the guiding principle, needs to be looked at, because I'm not seeing anyone out there that would in the actuarial world would say your underlying assumed long-term rate with annual obligations, you know, should be 8%.
Well, Chair Canup, Representative King, you've hit on something that is at the heart of this issue, and it also reflects back on the state of the statute. We have a set of structures in the statute and instructions, like the setting of the assumed rate, which is actually the board is instructed in statute to do so in consultation with an expert actuary and so on. That does, in fact, imply a long-term horizon that is ignorant of, and I don't mean that in a negative sense, but simply ignores fluctuations in between. Yet we have into the money match system, as you say, an annual tranche that gets accrued each and every time, and it is why money match is extremely sensitive not simply to the long-term assumptions, but to how you get there. This was one of the things we also learned in the simulation, that it's not that the actuary's work is incorrect. Given the way the actuary is asked to look at things, long-term, smooth, everything is linear, this work is fine. The problem is that it doesn't tell you the whole story, because there is this dynamic of annual tranche granting that is extremely sensitive, both from the member's point of view in terms of what they see in their account, but also in terms of funding obligations for employers, that happens, and they clash, is I guess the message that I'm trying to send. With respect to the assumed rate and whether it's correct or not, it is probably one of the hottest topics in corporate finance right now. Publics are 8% currently is still within the range of public system assumptions. Public systems are typically slow to change their assumed rates. Many corporations actually have higher assumed rates, and in fact, Warren Buffett spoke out on this very vehemently over the past several weeks, saying that, you know, that assuming 8.5, 9, 9.5, 10, 10.5% in some cases, and I can show you a chart of these by corporations that you'd all recognize, is tantamount to sort of raising current level earnings by deferring obvious pension obligations. It's something, of course, that our system wants to avoid. We want our books to everybody to have extreme confidence in our books.
Oh, and I understand, you know, the benefits of that, and particularly if you still have an old, you know, a defined benefit plan, if you can assume 9% returns, you don't have to fund very much in your pension plan. That's one reason why I'm very much against Tier 3. I think Tier 3 is, if it was just a defined benefit plan, would be a ripoff to the employees of the state. I think that our current funding, you know, process is the right way. And I'm not saying you're trying to mislead anybody, but I think it's really unfair to take a look at comparing our circumstance to corporate plans, because while it's reasonable to take a look and say historically you make 8 or 10% or so over a 30-year period, none of those corporate players also provide the 8% annual guaranteed tranche. We as a public entity are in that one on our own.
Chair Canope, Representative King, you're absolutely right. That is a special distinctive feature of our system that you don't see in traditional corporate defined benefit plans, and there aren't many, if any, new ones being put in place. But the assumed rates that I did cite, I believe, were all for defined benefit plans. So there is a service-based guarantee that is inherent in all defined benefit plans, as you point out. So all I'm saying is that the assumed rate is a very hot topic for all the reasons that you mentioned, as well as the ones I did. And the board, in fact, has to face that decision in the next 6 months. They'll receive a recommendation as part of the 2001 statutorily required valuation for rate setting, and it will include a recommendation either to stay with the 8% or to change it in some way. I don't know what I have not spoken with the actuary or the board on this topic to this point.
And I just want to make sure you are clear that I am requesting, you know, the wording of the assumptions of, you know, that underlie establishing the assumed rate.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you.
I have one more that I skipped, Chairman Canope, and that was question 4 about smoothing, and we even brought some pretty charts and graphs. For years, for all of its existence, I believe, the board set rates using estimates of the assets in hand at their current market value, this so-called mark-to-market method, what you knew you had in hand. Of course, investment results year to year vary so that asset number, as we just discussed, may in fact track the assumed rate very closely over a long period of time, but it can go up and down and up and down. To the extent that it goes up above and below the assumed rate, it tends to drag employer rates up and down with it. About 60% of public pension plans have adopted a so-called asset smoothing technique. That is, they take the mark-to-market number and they say, well, we can't deny that the assets are down or they're up relative to where they need to be actuarially, but we'll argue that over the long run they're going to track our assumed rate, so we'll recognize the difference above or below incrementally over time. The example on the left there, and it is just hypothetical, is that if rates were now at 10%, let's just argue, we've just picked a round number, and since 4% seems to be in play, I picked that one too. For the experience, the left-hand column, the left-hand axis represents the experience, investment experience that produces a necessary change in rates. In this case, for 2000 and 2001, it would be up 4%. This is all in biennia. Then what under the smoothing technique that the board has adopted, they would adopt 2% of that in 2003 and schedule the next 2%, schedule it because it has actually happened, schedule it for 2005. There's no free lunch in smoothing. All we've done is defer the amount of rate volatility that it looks like we're going to have to take at some point to the next valuation. But then when we get to 2002, 2003, we have another set of experience. In this example, let's argue that the experience of that period would have pushed rates down 1%. So now if you look out to the 2005 rate setting, which is the column going across, you see we have the 2% that's already been absorbed in the previous valuation. We have the 2% that's been scheduled and must be assumed. But now we also are able to schedule in half of the 1% decline from the 2002-2003 experience. So if you track down in 2005, smooth rates would have been 13.5, representing the incremental addition of all of those pieces of experience smoothed out, whereas mark-to-market would have been 13. So it would have been higher. Now, you continue that process out for a period of time, and I particularly picked an example where both methods by 2011 are producing the same rate. But if you turn to the chart that I've drawn here, what happens under smoothing is that rather than get from where you were, 10%, to where both methods would leave you at, 14%, smoothing gets you there with smaller biennial wiggles, if you will, less volatility. Whereas if you do mark-to-market, you have to follow the market up as high as it went or experience, because market is a big part of actuarial experience, but it's not all of it, and then you have to follow the rest down. In this case, we're only smoothing assets, so we're only smoothing investment experience. Now, when you look at this, you say, well, why doesn't everybody do this? Well, it has some critics as well. One of the criticisms is, well, you're not fully recognizing what reality is. You're, in essence, pushing off some of reality into the future, whether it's good reality or bad reality. And that's true. The second thing is that a key element of this is that you better be right about your assumed rate, because if you're not, if your assumed rate is too high, then what will happen is that you'll be smoothing underneath where you should be for a period of time before you realize that your investments aren't going to earn as much as you thought. And you will have, in essence, done some internal borrowing that has to be recaptured through contributions later. Plus, you have the criticism that you're fiddling with the books, if you will. But remember that 60% of pension plans adopt some form of this. I don't want to denigrate this whatsoever. In fact, I recommended it to the board. But I recommended it with something, and this was with the at the recommendation, actually, of our actuary, that we use something called a corridor. And the corridor says that we'll let the value of the assets that we use for rate setting differ from the real value at that time only by 10%, no more. Once it hits the 10%, every additional dollar after that, that it's either lower or higher, gets flowed into rates immediately. And that's kind of the self-discipline that we built into this process. So we get the benefits of smoothing, but we answer the critics who say, but gee, you know, are these the real numbers that you're using to set rates each and every time? We've tried to use that 10% corridor to say we won't go outside that corridor. So I don't know if I've confused you again about smoothing, but the bottom line is that it ameliorates the change, the rate of change in employer rates, but it doesn't change what the ultimate employer's funding obligation turns out to be.
Representative King.
You know, this is a tougher discussion. I'm kind of surprised that everybody in the back seems to be still awake on moving. But I think there's another problem inherent in it, and it's, you know, it may very well be a reasonable problem, but it's part of it's what you do in your world, but not in my world, I think. But I'd like to have some response on that. Since we're working in annual tranches with our returns, and let's say that I'm a person that's got a one-year benefit in 2003, and maybe you're a person that's got a one-year benefit in 2005, that the market's up 14%, but you're only giving me 12%. And so, I didn't capture 2% of, maybe what I would have been entitled to in my variable option. And the other side of the story then would be that you go out to year 2005, and I'm not there anymore, so I'm not part of the overall smoothing process, but you are, for example. And you get 13.5%, but the market only did 13%. So, in that circumstance, it kind of looks like we're not attributing to each person what they earn in their years. And so there's some transfer between different participants that have to be there at different points in time. And to some degree, our system is doing that over a broader range.
Chair Canope, Representative King, I have to apologize. I've left you with a misconception because of my analysis, my explanation wasn't complete, and this is my fault. This smoothing process is used only for employer rate setting, only for employer rate setting. So the earnings crediting process does take the actual annual earnings and distribute them. So the liability stream, if you will, that's represented by the size of members' accounts is not smoothed. It's not smoothed. Only the total assets in the system that are available to pay the total set of obligations. That's the only thing that's smooth, and it's smooth only for the purpose of setting the next move in employer rates. So I apologize. I left you with the wrong impression.
Well, thanks for the clarification. I was wondering why I asked to see where that was at. Right.
Jim, I have a question regarding the timeline. And my question is in 1978, it indicates that the employee deficit deficit reserve liquidated, gain loss reserve liquidated. What happened in 1978 that led to the liquidation of those? Was there a specific purpose, or was that something that was happening for a market condition, or?
I believe that, Chair Canope, that the liquidation most likely occurred because investment results were poor and the size of the reserve was insufficient to make up the difference. We can go back and check that for sure, but I believe that's the statutorial manner by which that reserve can be defunded or liquidated, if you will. In fact, I'm not sure that there is any other way that we're allowed to take money out of the gain loss reserve, which, by the way, exists only under the concept of equal crediting, that doesn't involve the provision of the Tier 1 guarantee.
Representative King?
PERS's investments in 78, 79 were pretty heavy fixed income, not exclusively, but I think they were heavier then. And that's a point in time when the Feds closed the window and interest rates went up dramatically. So you're probably looking at a substantial fixed income portfolio at 6-8%, you know, very shortly, you know, thereafter, we were looking at interest rates at 14, 15, 16, and so on higher. And, you know, so there were a lot of, you know, huge losses on the bond side, you know, of the equation, you know, then. That may not be the, you know, the right thing, because the market was kind of mediocre in 77, 78, but that's right at the point in time when we were seeing huge losses of fixed income.
Thank you.
Have we covered everything that the committee expects of us, the task force expects of us? I believe that we...
Number 12, you commented on in responding to Representative Butler.
Right.
Just one last question. How much money did you bring with you today to fill that $8.5 billion liability? And when can we have the check?
As I read my job description, I think I'm supposed to collect that money, but...
Well, you are until we change the job description, I guess.
Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you. Our schedule calls for work group to meet directly after this in room 350, so I will try to be prompt to get over there as soon as we're done here. Representative King, if you want to sit in, I know I think Elaine's part of that, and she's not here. If you'd want to sit in on that, just to be informed, if you have the time, great. Representative Butler, are you going to join me?
Yes, sir.
Great. And because Representatives Walker and Hobson and Doyle weren't here, Jim, if you could make sure that they get the information along with Kara, who apparently left for vacation for this afternoon session. Make sure that they all get the information that we got for the day. Thank you very much. And with that, the committee will stand adjourned.